Welcome to the Spoolcast. Jason Ulasic and Brian Winters join Adam Churchill in this follow-up to Jason's virtual seminar, Design as a Business Tool, From Research to Experience Roadmaps. Jason didn't have time to answer all the questions during the seminar, so we decided to address those remaining questions in this podcast. If you didn't attend the seminar, don't worry. There's plenty here for you, too. And now, here's Adam.
Welcome everyone to another edition of the Spoolcast. Recently, Jason Ulasic joined us to present his virtual seminar, Design as a Business Tool, From Research to Experience Roadmaps. Jason's seminar, along with 115 others that teach the tools and techniques you need to create great design, is now part of the UIE User Experience Training Library and soon to be unveiled as part of UIE's All You Can Learn. Designers face this sometimes daunting responsibility of influencing where organizations spend money and time to gain a stronger customer experience. In the seminar, Jason shows how he's wrapped several UX tools and processes into a repeatable framework for designing great customer experiences. In the seminar, he also shares how storytelling can provide vital insights that remove politics and create a foundation for artifacts that inform your business decisions. Now, we asked Jason to be part of the UIE virtual seminar program because we saw an earlier version of this presentation at Interactions 13 in Toronto earlier in 2013. At the time, it was a co-presentation with Brian Winters, and they worked together at Manifest Digital in Chicago. For today's podcast, we've invited them both to come back and sort of discuss some of the issues that were prevalent in the seminar and some of the remaining questions from our audience. So, Jason and Brian, welcome, and thanks so much for taking some time to join us.
Thanks a lot. It's great to follow up with some discussion.
Thanks, Adam.
So, for those that weren't with us for your seminar, Jason, can you give us an overview?
Sure. Yeah. The seminar was really around, as you mentioned, connecting the dots as designers. I think as designers, we have this opportunity and this innate ability to be able to take these activities and tools and approaches that we have to really help hone in on how to make the right type of business decisions or help influence them, help inform them, right? And I think that that's what we're doing today as designers, and that's gravitated and made its way all the way from many years of hard work in our industry to be able to really be at the table in terms of how to guide and help set some of the future direction for organizations. And so this seminar was really a story about some of the work that we've done, Brian and I, and I would call it a methodology, although that's a pretty strong word at times. It's an approach, maybe is a better word for it, that we've devised partly because we needed to be able to tell the story ourselves about how design can have an influence to setting the longer term direction for organizations creating products and services, whether that be from scratch or, you know, kind of reimagining products and services that they already have out there for any number of years. And so that has led us into a bit of that approach that if you joined us, you saw and listened to. And we're going to chat a little bit about some of the follow-up questions around that today. But in reality, it's turning design and the processes and the skills that we have into this business decision framework and laying it out so that you understand what you're working with, the goals and objectives that companies have, that stakeholders have, what our, you know, end users are looking for, unlocking that through research that's well crafted and intended to inform kind of the entire customer life cycle, that we can also use in part with some competitive analysis to inform where we need to support, where do we need to fill in the gaps, where do we need to optimize the entire customer experience. And then a bit about, out of all the things that we could do, both small, medium, and large, how do we set the right direction and how do we do that in a way that takes some of the politics out of the decision-making process and looks at the drivers of, you know, kind of importance and the goals and objectives for both customers and business stakeholders, and prioritize those into a bit of a roadmap, if you will, and ultimately wrap that all into a story that can be used to create shared understanding within organizations. And that's the story of the storytelling, I guess I would say, as we work with clients.
Very cool. Well, let's get to some of those questions. Obviously, you spent some time talking about assessing the competitive landscape, and there were some really good questions that came in regarding that. So, Jason, when you're trying to get your head around this understanding of your competitive experiences, what are some of the methods you use to do that?
Yeah, that's great. So I guess I'll cover off on kind of the secondary means first. You know, there's a ton of research available through a number of different partners and sources, you know, organizations like Forrester that can provide deep insights relative to specific industries or specific situations, which is extremely helpful when you may not necessarily have access to all the business insight around the competition in the space. So, you know, we'll look at that to kind of steep ourselves in understanding kind of broadly. And then, you know, primarily what we'll wind up doing is we look at design, and I say that in a broad sense, and we look at that from an interaction, we look at that from a branding and identity standpoint, a content strategy standpoint, front-end technology and development, there's some marketing in there. You know, you can throw in all these various disciplines that equate to the overall experience, and you start to look at them as a cross-discipline, almost heuristic, right? And we know that there are some solid practices to follow. And it's one that we live by as designers many times over. And we work with our clients to walk through those and then identify any other, you know, additional ones we need to consider. And then we start to talk about, well, what are we trying to solve? What are we trying to best understand? And so when we look at, let's say, one app versus another, two competitors, it's important for us to understand things like organizational principles of the design. What's the personality of the design? What's the content that's being delivered? How is it being delivered? What's the reveal of that? How is branding and identity treated as it relates to those competitors and laddering back up to brand promise and values? How is the interaction design handled, right? Think about the importance of many of those factors today around navigation and flow, and you wind up with either experiences that excel or experiences that really suck, that have a negative connotation or a perception on the brand overall. And so, you know, we identify a number of those criteria and start to assign levels of scoring. And although it's at times a little subjective, we try to objectify it by defining what constitutes a 1 versus a 5. And we follow that same pattern throughout a number of direct competitors. And that's important because it starts to give us, you know, it's not the extremely scientific, but it gives us a way into understanding and talking about the value of design and the direction of the experience that one competitor takes over the other and why something is more powerful, right? Or at least unlocking additional questions about, you know, is this really one of the reasons why it's driving, you know, growth and engagement? The personality and feedback, that how responsive this experience is. And that's kind of a key indicator for us to kind of set the bar with working with our clients. And lastly, the other aspect to think about is the indirect competitors. So many times we forget about these indirect competitors, and these are the brands that we all know and love that, you know, you walk into an Apple store, or you have an experience with an Apple product or service or employee, and that sets the bar. Much as like if you went into a department store like a Nordstrom's, those start to set the bar for your experience around similar brands that that persona or that archetype will gravitate towards. And so even if your client's in insurance and they're working and expecting the experience they get out of a Nordstrom's and Apple, you know, that bar is raised, and it's important to understand that.
Brian, let's talk a bit about research activity selection and its purpose. How early in the decision cycle do you involve the end users?
Well, from my perspective as a researcher, it's never too early to talk to an end user because I think there's always something to learn with every conversation. But it's important that you talk to people as soon as you have a clear idea of your objectives, the goals that you have for the design, and you know what you're going to use in terms of success factors. Once you have that outlined and you know the goals of the organization or the stakeholders you're dealing with, and you've done some stakeholder interviews to kind of understand the customer from their point of view, you can then begin to craft an approach to talk to people. So, you know, I like to talk to end users earlier than later, but that's not always feasible given timelines and clients' appetite for research.
Do you use observations as a research technique in addition to the interviews you're conducting with them?
Oh, absolutely. It depends. Like a lot of things in user experience, you can answer with it depends. But we did some research with people who are shopping for homeowners insurance, and we could have easily done that just through interviews. But we went into people's homes and we did an interview. But then we would ask them a question like, well, how do you go about comparing your policies? And then we watched people go to the back of their house, find a dusty box, open it up, then sift through it to try to find their insurance policy while they're on their hands and knees, cursing the whole time that they have to find this document that they never, ever need to access. So that observation, and you know, we didn't know that that was going to be an important part of our understanding, but watching them go back and try to dig out their policy so they can do an apples-to-apples comparison while they're shopping was really important to them, and the stress that they went through to find it was an important part of our findings. So that leads to, you know, is there maybe a possibility here, another solution, and making their policies more easily acceptable and make it easier for them to do that analysis? So, yeah, when you do have things that require context as an important part of your understanding, observation is always a good thing to do.
So one of the things that's interesting about this process, so Jason's presentation talks a bit about and introduces the concepts of a mental model and a process called gap analysis. What happens when you're thinking about a new product or service where there's no existing solutions available? How do those two pieces come into play?
Well, when you're talking about a new product and a mental model, you know, doing the gap analysis, what do you have the gap against? Well, I think you can create the model and then just take a step back and start to insert possible solutions, right? So instead of doing the gap analysis, you do some brainstorming and you try to innovate on what people are experiencing. You know, do your synthesis on the top part of the model, and then the bottom part of the model is where you outline opportunities. So those are things we've done in the past where we've actually skipped the process of doing the inventory of how the products and services of the client are supporting the mental model and gone right to possibilities. So you can use it to understand where some experience gaps might be, because you're looking at how people are motivated, what their behaviors are, what they're thinking, feeling, and believing about an experience, agnostic of technology or brands. So when you look at it that way, it's easy to take a step back and see where some of the pain points and gaps are in the experience, regardless of whether you have a product to match it against or not.
Jason, I know you had something to share about how you modify this process for a new project versus an existing ongoing project.
Yeah, I think, you know, to add on what Brian was talking about, kind of the top half of the model versus the bottom half of the model. And I think it's as you progress over time with your understanding of what's happening within the customer's experience from beginning to end and everywhere in between, hopefully you continue to do things like usability testing, going out, visiting with your customers, rolling up your sleeves, doing, you know, various different types of research activities and listening to what's going on into the organization. And so that's really important, first and foremost, because this type of model is foundational. It's meant to be continued to be built upon. And so what does that look like? That looks like, hey, you know, we completed the first project and we blew this thing out and we printed it out on a plotter and it's 10 feet long and we put it on a wall. Awesome. So it's now a physical thing that sits in the office and people can kind of go up to it and kind of understand what's happening and transpiring in the customer's mindset. Now, as things progress and you gather additional insights from usability testing or other research activities, we will typically wind up adding post-it notes or just writing, you know, directly on the model itself. And those things will constitute from like new insights from customers, quotes, emotions, feelings, activities, right? We start to fill in maybe some more of the gaps that we maybe didn't have as much depth in the past, as well as obviously as organizations move forward, there's constant influx of new digital or physical products and services that are being introduced. And so you need to be able to make sure that you understand, okay, the purpose of that tool is to serve the management of X service. All right, awesome. So let's add that to the bottom of the model where we think it belongs. And as we continue to move on, we'll have more discussion in an upcoming usability lab when we have a few minutes to ask about, hey, are you using X tool? What do you think, right? And so that gives us the ability to continue to move these things forward. In terms of a management and update standpoint, it's really kind of up to, you know, the team and the organization in which when there's a gigantic amount of post-it notes all over the wall, all over the model, then it's typically a good indicator of, okay, let's pull these back into the model itself digitally and reprint the mental model.
Yeah, I know of some teams out there, UX teams, that actually formed a mental model team to continuously update the model, because what they found is the first time they did it with one segment of users, and then they have a different business unit come to them and say, hey, what about these customers? Because we're really interested in this part of their experience. And so they did more research and they found that they had to augment it. So what started out as a 12-foot long model wound up being 60 feet long after a couple of years of continuing analysis. What I think is great about that story is that they actually have a mental model team that's dedicated to that. And they actually go out and proactively advocate for the mental model and the customer point of view. And so that's an important lesson, that this is something, this is an artifact that is meant to be worked. And to Jason's point, it being foundational, you continue to build that foundation so that it becomes very strong. And out of that comes many different ideas, and you can attach all kinds of different projects to it, especially when it's more of a mature model, and get something out of it.
So, Brian, one of the things about our audience is they're always looking for resources. And during the virtual seminar, when the mental models piece came up, a lot of folks were looking for, you know, is there a digital online tool that you can recommend for this? Is there? Or is the wall of post-it notes that Jason referred to and a couple of whiteboards still the best way to go?
I would love to find that digital online tool. No, I'm just kidding. So I use post-it notes for a very specific reason. I know Indy Young, who developed this methodology, uses Excel, and that's her way of doing it. But I use post-it notes, one, because it helps me kind of see the big picture. So it's kind of like the matching game. So when you've got your affinity clusters, I can take a step back and start to see patterns visually on a big wall in front of me. The second thing it does is it gives me the opportunity to bring in stakeholders and immerse them in the research and get them talking about patterns, get them engaged, get them holding a post-it note in their hand and doing something with it. And so we're together as human beings in a room solving this problem we have of clustering all this data into something meaningful. So I think there's a very valuable part of using the post-it notes. But in the end, you have to get to something that's digitized and that you can then print out. So like I mentioned, Indy uses Excel. I've used Excel as well to sort. And she has, I think on her blog someplace, there is a Python script that you can use to extract the data from Excel, and I think it pumps it into Visio. But you can also use something like Omni Outliner, where you can basically put the outline of the mental model into Omni Outliner and then just drag the Outliner file onto the OmniGraphle icon, and it will ask you, how do you want to build this? And it's an org chart. You know, it's kind of a workaround, but it takes your data outline and puts it into an org chart, and then it's easier to then manipulate that into all the boxes and clusters and towers that you need to have. But there is not one tool out there that I've found that is a mental model builder. Maybe that's an opportunity for someone out there to create such an application and deliver it to the market, because I think that there's more you can build on top of that kind of application, not just the mental model. There's much more data you can get out of that and slice and dice for other initiatives.
I think that would be an area of where we would be excited to collaborate.
Yes.
So one of the things that we run into is every once in a while, something really cool gets labeled a certain way, and then there becomes a bit of confusion with how it might relate to something else. And Jason, can you talk a bit about the difference between the experience map and a mental model?
Sure. So I think you're right, Adam. You know, we will use terms in our profession, we have a tendency to debate the hell out of different definitions and terms and titles and roles and all sorts of fun things. And I guess at its most important level here, the thing that we need to understand is the mental model provides a foundation. Think of it as a data store, a database, a way of saying, here's what we know about our customers, and here's how they think, act, they feel, they behave, and also what are the things that they use in those spaces amidst all those activities and feelings and beliefs that they have. And so if you look at it that way, right, as this collection that you can build on over time, you can start to say, okay, now what's an experience map? Well, that really is mapping through various scenarios for a persona of the customer landscape and saying, how do I start to pull out some of the emotions, the feelings, the actions, and the tools that are currently being used or also future looking, right? Forward looking, that we may need to create, innovate, find to support those activities. And so that becomes more about the flow and the interaction of the experience across various different products and services that your organization may have. And if you think about it that way, that starts to hopefully clearly define the distinction between the two. Because you could throw in something like customer journey map as well. We will typically use the term experience map and customer journey pretty interchangeably.
Yeah, it's certainly an interchange of definitions and labels that we're hearing. So I'm going to pitch the UIE virtual seminar library, what we're calling All You Can Learn. We have a virtual seminar with Indy Young talking about her mental models. We have one from Jeff Patton on story mapping. Can you compare and contrast those? Explain the difference.
So my understanding of the story mapping is that it's a somewhat similar outcome, but a different approach. So I'll start with the mental models. The data that comes out of the mental models is derived from interviews, non-directed interviews. So these are open interviews that are really driven by the participant and somewhat guided by the moderator. It's them telling us their story. It's telling us about their experience, why they're feeling certain things, what they're thinking about, how they're motivated. And all of that data then winds up on, for me, post-it notes. And then we organize that into clusters. And so it's a bottom-up kind of approach to building the understanding of the person's experience. From what I understand of Jeff's story mapping, is that's more of kind of the internal view. What do we already know about customers? And how do we take what we already know about customers and build a model to help us understand what we develop first? What's the first priority? What's second priority? So I find that something really useful in the development environment, especially when you know pretty well what your customers need. You may be the kind of organization that's in touch with your customers, or maybe you are the customer because you use the product, right? So you can start to develop an understanding for what people are going through based on your perspective or based on research you've already done. So I think the main difference is the amount of research and the type of research that goes into developing these. One is bottom up, the other one is top down, but hopefully it's informed by other things you've been doing in your organization. So I think they're both useful, but the context for a mental model is more about generating, it's generative research, right? So what are the new ideas that we can find to delight people? What are we missing in the experience? And story mapping is taking things we already know and outlining it in such a way so we can assign priority and map that out for a development plan. That's my understanding of it.
Brian, talk a bit about facilitating the process. Earlier, there was this mention of sort of the mental models team. Really cool concept. When you're collaborating with the project team and getting into the mental models, you know, designers and people working on projects like that, there's this tendency to immediately jump to the solutions. How do you avoid that?
Well, I'm not sure you avoid it if you have low-hanging fruit that you can tackle, right? I've done mental model research where we're into the third interview and the client is hearing things that they can fix right away. There's nothing wrong with going ahead and attacking low-hanging fruit. I think what you need to do is when the solutions start to be very broad and strategic And longer term, that's where I think you can run into a slippery slope of narrowing your focus too much. So it's okay to have those solutions pop up. I think early on, you put them on a parking lot and you let the process flow as it's meant to. The thing about uncovering solutions is insights take time. It is not something where you get 1,300 data points, which is a recent mental model that I did, 1,300 post-it notes, where you have 1,300 post-it notes on the wall, and then you organize it and you have your answer. That's where I think we struggle as consultants with our clients, because we do this work and we come and deliver something that maybe they, hopefully they believe is wonderful, but it feels like magic to them. Well, it's not. It's a lot of sweat equity. It's a little bit of luck. It's good data. So it's all of those things that go into developing insights and innovation that in time, like time is probably the most critical part of this. It's like a good stew. It might taste good the first day, but you leave it in the fridge for a couple of days and wow, it does get better, right? We've all had those experiences with food where just let it kind of sit there and everything meld together. And that's how my brain works sometimes. I need to sleep on things. I need to let my brain figure out the problems while I'm napping. We get more clear that way. So it's important that we express to people that this is not the final answer. This is a living document that is going to hopefully give you potential solutions for a long time to come, maybe for the next 5 to 10 years if you've done a really good, deep and broad research effort.
I think the one thing I would add on is I think Brian hit it on the head there, is there's a part of the process that's about gelling. And that requires a variety of different disciplines and skills to kind of look at what's coming out of the wall and speaking to you if you're using post-it notes to put them all over the place and examining those, right? And you really have to look at those the statements that are on those notes and really analyze it. It's a tough process. It's one that you have to set expectations going into it as clearly as you can. It's iterative, right? So you may go down one path and find out that like, oh, well, we're starting to organize it the wrong way.
Yeah.
And you find a bunch of nuggets that inform you on kind of almost pivoting at times, right? I mean, we've had that situation with a number of projects. And that's an important thing to always, if you're doing this as a consultant or if you're doing that internally, you know, for your own company, you have to make sure that you keep communication at a high level. And then, you know, doing this should also be as an open space, right? So if you can find a highly visible space within the organization, within the office to do this, I would highly encourage you to do that because you need lots of really great insight and understanding and people who have answers to help inform a little bit more of the depth as you get into it. And that's really important to get that point across to, you know, those stakeholders, that it's not the design team or the mental model team, just a bunch of designers getting in a room and throwing post-its on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, we have this wonderfully looking thing, right? It's an iterative process that requires involvement across the board. And you do that in such a way that I think you have to think about the structure you create when you invite stakeholders into it. As a designer, we have to design just as much so as we're designing the synthesis of the data and how we're going to do it, the plan. We have to design the experience for those stakeholders because that's where they're going to kind of soak up all that knowledge if they weren't directly participating in all the research themselves. And take that knowledge and think about those customers and bring that to their daily business lives, right?
Yeah.
That's key.
I think it's also setting their expectation for what kind of research this is. It's not research to solve their problems only. Like, you can find solutions to problems, but let's think about it in terms of possibilities. What's possible? What are we missing? What can we read between the lines of what people were telling us or the data to find something? So that's insights, right? So if it's framed around problem resolution, well, maybe that's just usability tests. But if you want to do some core generative research and pull something strategic out of this for the long term and really deeply understand the people you're trying to serve, I think it's about possibilities more than anything else. And that takes time. It's not an instant solution tool. So those opportunities will present themselves throughout the interviews and through the data analysis. And I think we should go after those low-hanging fruit, if it makes sense. but let's keep perspective and consider the possibilities that come out of the data more as strategic outputs than anything else.
Jason and Brian, this was great. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for inviting us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
To our audience, thanks for listening in and for your support of the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Goodbye for now.
Purchase access to recordings of all of our previous virtual seminars in our virtual seminar catalog. Just go to uie.com/virtual_seminars. As always, thank you for listening.